This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Banks Centre for Astrophysics. For the full show and archives, visit jodcast.net.
And today for the Jodcast interview, we welcome Professor Stefan Soldner-Rembold, Head of Particle Physics at Manchester University. So Stefan, would you like to tell us a little bit about yourself?
Well, yes, I've been in Manchester since 2003 and I worked at various big particle physics labs before that. And I have been a particle physicist for the last 30 years, worked on a range of big experiments at CERN, DAISY, Fermilab, all the big laboratories.
And you're now working on the DUNE project. So where's that based and what's your involvement in it?
So the DUNE project, Deep Underground Neutrino Experiment, is based or will be based in America at Fermilab, which is a national lab in Chicago or close to Chicago. To be more precise, because the experiment is actually about sending a beam of neutrinos to a large underground detector, which will be in a mine in South Dakota. So it is in both locations. The biggest part of the detector will be in this mine deep underground in South Dakota.
So Fermilab is Chicago. Mm-hmm. Now, the only thing I know about it is, isn't there a freeway running over the accelerator?
No, that's not true.
Oh, that's such a shame, because I remember driving over it and seeing the building and thinking, wow, I'm driving over a LINAC. Oh, no. That's another story that dies a death. Oh, well. So the idea is that you're sending a strong beam of neutrinos from Chicago to South Dakota. What are you looking at in terms of the neutrinos? I mean, do we need to go back a little bit and do a little bit of particle physics just to make sure that we're all at the same in the same boat? So my understanding is we've got two main groups of particles, hadrons and leptons.
Yeah, so there are hadrons and leptons, and the fundamental particles, they are both leptons and quarks. The quarks make up the hadrons. Leptons actually originally meant light particles, and hadrons meant heavy particles. Yeah. That's the original meaning of that. The leptons we have, they are the electron, which we're all familiar with, but also its heavier brothers and sisters, which are the muon and the tau. So they all come in three families. And then there are the neutrinos. They also come in three families: an electron neutrino, a muon neutrino, and a tau neutrino. Now, different from the electron and the muon and the tauon, the neutrinos have no charge, and they are much, much lighter.
I studied my undergraduate degree quite some time ago, and at that point the question was whether neutrinos had mass at all.
Yes. Originally, in what we call the standard model of particle physics, which is kind of encompasses all our understanding of how these particles interact and how it works, neutrinos didn't have any mass, and people believed that they were massless, like photons, for example. Yeah. But in the 70s, there was experimental evidence that the neutrinos coming from the sun, they were actually much fewer than what you expected, only about a third of what you expected. And that experiment was actually done in the same mine where now DUNE will be built a long time ago. And for a while, people were thinking perhaps we don't understand how the sun works, but it turned out that was not the issue. The issue was that some of the neutrinos on their way out of the sun had actually changed their properties. We call that neutrino oscillations. So they actually go from one type of neutrino to another type of neutrino. And the only way this works and is possible is that they have mass. So from that effect, we know they have to have mass, but a very, very small mass.
I mean, we're not talking about the solution to dark matter here, are we?
No, people have thought about neutrinos being dark matter, but it's because the way neutrinos work, their masses are very, very small. They could not really be viable candidates for dark matter. So it's unlikely that neutrinos are the dark matter particles we are looking for.
So these neutrinos are oscillating between the different types, the electron, the tau, the muon. Do we understand the mechanism by which this change is taking place?
Oh, yeah, we understand that mechanism. That has something to do with the weak interaction and the fact that there are different, what we call, eigenstates. So the neutrinos You can look at them in two ways. You can say there's an electron neutrino and a muon neutrino and a tau neutrino, and that we call flavor. The other way of looking at the same neutrinos is we can say there are three mass eigenstates. So there's a neutrino 1, a neutrino 2, and neutrino 3 that have each a separate mass.
Mm-hmm.
And now a quantum mechanical effect comes into play, which has to do with the fact that these eigenstates, as we call them in quantum mechanics, are not the same as the flavor eigenstates. And that is an effect, it's a quantum mechanical effect, which leads to these oscillations between neutrino flavors.
So is Dune designed to try and further understand that mechanism?
Yes, there have been quite a few experiments that have made measurements related to neutrino oscillations, and we have a fairly good understanding. But one of the things, for example, we do not understand yet is whether neutrinos and their antiparticles behave differently. We actually don't even know whether neutrinos are particles where you have a separate particle and antiparticle, or whether particle and antiparticle are the same. That
right.
We don't know. So let me step back a little bit. Let's say we have an electron and the antiparticle is a positron.
Yes.
So one is negatively charged, one is positively charged. For a neutrino, if you would make a particle, take a particle, make an antiparticle out of it, the charge wouldn't change. So in principle,
right.
It could be possible that it's actually the same thing. And we don't know whether that is the case.
Right.
And the other question, so this will be addressed by different type of experiments, but the other question, fundamental question we don't understand yet, is do neutrinos and antineutrinos behave differently?
Mm.
And that's called CP violation. And that has something to do with this fundamental problem: why is there more matter than antimatter in the universe?
So we look at the Big Bang. In theory, we should have equal amounts of matter and antimatter.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, at the moment, we don't seem to have that.
Obviously, and luckily we don't have it because we are here. There is a symmetry between matter and antimatter, and we don't really know where it comes from. And there is a theory which is called leptogenesis, so that's leptons again, which explains this asymmetry through an asymmetry which happens related to leptons. And what we are looking for is studying and discovering whether neutrinos behave differently from antineutrinos or not.
Dune is a big project. You talked in terms of, is it several hundred people involved in...
Oh, yeah. So currently Dune is about 1,000 people from all over the world.
So we're talking about something that's not quite CERN, but you know,
it's the next big project in particle physics, and you know, one of the LHC experiments are about 3,000 people, and I expect that Dune will be more than 1,000 people once it turns on.
Once it's turned on, it's going to be monitoring this flow of neutrinos from Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
What are you going to be looking for in terms of your results? I suppose we need to, again, step back and look at the process by which you detect neutrinos.
Yeah, so one of the problems with neutrinos is that they rarely interact. Now, that's good for us because, of course, there are many, many neutrinos around us all the time. There are 10 to the 12th, like a million times a million neutrinos going through our body per centimeter squared every second. And fortunately, they don't do much because, otherwise it would be a problem. But for the experimenters, this is an issue because in order to find any neutrino interaction, you have to build a very, very large experiment with a lot of mass so that you find, even when you have an intense, very intense neutrino beam, so that you find interactions. So there are different ways of doing that, but in Dune, the way it's going to be done, you have a very large, or actually four very large tanks of liquid argon,
right,
which each contain 10 kilotons of, so that's a lot of liquid argon, just to give a feeling. So each of these tanks will be like 20 times 20 times 60 meters large.
That's big.
Yeah. And so the neutrinos interact and they produce charged particles in these interactions. And those charged particles, they create ionization, which is more charge in that liquid argon.
Mm.
And that's what you're looking for.
So you get these charge tracks that you can then see in the argon.
Mm.
You can build an image of the interaction, the sort of things that we're used to seeing at CERN. So that's sort of like an electrode on one side which pulls the charge.
Yeah, so it's quite different from the way you do this in a collider experiment. You have the liquid argon. The neutrino creates a charged particle which goes through the liquid argon. It creates the secondary charge. Mm-hmm. You apply a very high voltage, hundreds, kilovolts. Mm. The charge drifts through the liquid argon to the anode. A pulse is registered, and you reconstruct where the particle went through by the location of the wires and by the time it takes to drift. And the drift is actually over several meters. Mm-hmm. So these charges drift through the liquid argon over distances of several meters. And then you can register with a very high precision, like a millimeter resolution, this track where it was. And you have to imagine it like, you know, drifting through that liquid argon until it hits the anode and is read out.
The original South Dakota observatory, did it use chlorine?
Yes, that's correct.
So you've moved to argon. What are the advantages of moving to argon?
So the original experiment was not an experiment where you could directly register the interaction. So you created atoms in the chlorine, which you had to filter out. So there was a filtering process.
Nice.
And it was like an offline measurement, if you want.
So you simply count the number of interactions.
Yes, exactly. Right. Whereas here, we register the interactions directly and we reconstruct them in space and time. Mm. Whereas this original experiment just measured how many interactions happened within the time frame where you filtered your chlorine again and you looked for these secondary products, and that is not the same.
So the Dune detector is deep underground. Why is it where it is? It's costing a lot, isn't it, to set that project up?
It's roughly a mile underground in a former gold mine in close to Deadwood, South Dakota, so you're in the deep American West. And it's a over 100-year-old gold mine, which is a huge. I've been there. You know, it's first there was a huge hole in the ground, and then when at some point they ran out of, you know, the possibility to dig a hole, so they just dig deeper. And for 100 years it was a mine. Now the reason you do this is because neutrino interactions are so rare, you're always worried about background. Mm. And one background is cosmic rays, which bombard us all the time. If you're on the surface, you get a lot of those. So we have a smaller liquid argon detector at Fermilab right now. It's called Microboon. And you know, for every interaction we record, we see like 15, 20 cosmic rays going through the detector. Now that's okay, you can filter it out in the smaller detector, but if you would have something like Dune, it would be very difficult to do that. So you want to go underground to basically get rid of all this cosmic ray background which you have on the surface.
So with Dune, you're trying to isolate everything you can from outside influences. You're interested really in the beam, but this is an astronomy podcast. So the question is, how is this linked into astronomy?
So we have different sources of neutrinos, and we will use neutrinos from different sources in this experiment. So what I talked about first were the accelerator neutrinos, which are produced at Fermilab. They go through the Earth and you find them in Dune. But there are also neutrinos from the atmosphere, from cosmic rays. The muons we just talked about are accompanied by neutrinos. These neutrinos you can also see in Dune. And more importantly, there are neutrinos from astrophysical events such as supernovae. And a supernova can actually produce a lot of neutrinos. 99% of the energy of a supernova are produced in the form of neutrinos, emitted in the form of neutrinos. So if we had a supernova relatively close by, somewhere in our galaxy, for example, we would potentially see thousands of neutrino interactions within a short time span, about 10 seconds, in that detector from the supernova. And that would teach us a lot about how a supernova works, but also about the neutrinos themselves.
And we've already detected neutrinos from a supernova.
Yeah, that was 1987. There was this supernova 1987A, and several neutrino experiments were online at the time. was a coincidence, you know, because you don't know when it comes. But at that time, all these experiments worldwide found 24 neutrino events. Mm. Now, we talk about potentially finding thousands for this one single supernova event, which we hope for. Now, a supernova of that size and that close to where we are, we expect something like once every 30 years. So, you know, one could be lucky or not, but there's also a lot of other physics you could do in that area. The supernova, if they are further away, you will still see signals, but it will not be quite so spectacular.
So you're not looking at thousands of events, you might be looking at tens of events, but you'd still get something out of that. Are there other projects? Because, I mean, you said that in 1987 there were several observatories looking for neutrinos and they detected signals at a similar sort of time, and that was sort of confirmation. Mm-hmm. Are there other observatories in operation around the world that would be able to corroborate sort of those findings?
So other observatories that look for neutrinos, of course, there's the Ice Cube experiment at the South Pole. They look more for high energy neutrinos, so that's on the other end of the spectrum, and they have seen spectacular events where they saw the highest neutrinos, highest energy neutrinos ever recorded over the last few years. Another type of experiment is where you don't use liquid argon, but use water. And there is a competitor experiment, if you want, or a complementary experiment in Japan. It's currently, the current version is called Super Kamiokande, but there is an extension upgrade planned, which will be Hyper Kamiokande. And what you do there is you have a big tank of underground water, megatons. The advantage of water, obviously, is that liquid argon is relatively cheap, but water is even cheaper. So you can build huge tanks. And there you reconstruct these events, these interactions in a different way. You use an effect which we call Cherenkov radiation. So when a...
That's that blue glow you get
In a reactor.
So
the neutrino produces a charged particle. We never see the neutrino itself. It's always through what it produces. And if it's an electron neutrino, then it will produce an electron. If it's a muon neutrino, it will produce a muon. Mm-hmm. That charged particle will go through the water, will produce Cherenkov light, a cone of Cherenkov light. Mm-hmm. And that you reconstruct with photomultipliers, which are detectors that register light outside which are on the periphery of the tank. And they can also do this kind of physics.
So at some point, supernova 2020A is hopefully far enough away that it doesn't fry us, but close enough that we get some decent data from it. And you will get this sort of storm of neutrinos and the Japanese and the Ice Cube, and you'll be able to find out more about the process of what happens in a supernova.
Yeah, you learn about the different phases in a supernova, because you also, in an experiment like Dune, you can register and distinguish between the different type of neutrinos, and you expect a different flavor or type of neutrino to come out of the supernova at different times. Originally, you have something like neutronization, where you would produce predominantly electron neutrinos, and you can see those where basically the protons and the electrons are pushed together to produce neutrons. And then later you would expect in the second phase that all different types of neutrino flavor are produced at equal or similar rates. So by, you know, that's in particular models, and there are different models, but you know, by studying the time evolution of this neutrino signal over the 10 seconds, you can say something about how the supernova works. But you could also, you know, for example, the original supernova has given us information, even with those 20 events, about the mass of the neutrinos, because if neutrinos have different masses, and they are not zero, the signal, because of relativistic effects, you should see some effect on the time it takes to get here.
Yes.
This, for example, one thing you can also look at.
So June is, what's the time scale? For June, where are you at the moment, and when are you going to start recording data, and how long are you going to be recording for?
So currently, the status is that this year, 2017, the cavity will be built where the detector will go. So this is mine, of course, exists, but in order to have a cavity of sufficient size and you know, with all the infrastructure that you need for this experiment, you have to actually build that, and that's going to be done. This process will start this year. At the same time, we are now building prototype detectors, so called Protodune, which will be constructed and operated at CERN, and they just test the technology and make sure that these large liquid argon detectors really work.
Yeah,
and then the experiments. So we have four of these big tanks. So we hope having the first ones operational in the early 2020s.
Yeah,
and then we'll probably run without beam for a while, and then around 2026, the beam will be there, which comes from Fermilab. So in the middle of the 2020s, you expect it within less than 10 years, the experiments to come online. And then it will take a few years before you can start doing physics from the beginning, but before we really have conclusive results on the CP question. And so it will probably take a few years.
Wow, so you're looking at maybe 2030.
Yeah, yeah. It's but all these projects, I mean, if you look at the LHC, it's the same thing.
The
timescale of these projects are now, these are almost generational projects.
It's proper big science, isn't
it? Yeah, no, it is big science.
June has got its work cut out, trying to work out CP violation, leptogenesis, etc. What do you see as being the next big thing in particle physics in terms of this is a question that we want to answer and we haven't answered yet?
The situation has changed a little bit from where we were at a few years ago, where we had a clear goal, which was driven by the open question, does the Higgs boson exist? And that was part of the standard model. And to complete the standard model, we needed to see the Higgs boson. And that happened a few years ago. And that was an important discovery. Now, there are very important questions left, but we are more in an exploratory phase where
you have to find out what the questions are.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So where is really the area where new physics will show up? And the CP violation question regarding neutrinos, which we talked about before, is certainly one of the most important ones. And neutrinos are a fascinating part of the, this journey to find physics, new physics beyond the standard model. Their other question is there supersymmetry? You know, that's what the LHC looks for currently. There is no indication for supersymmetry from the LHC. That raises questions of whether there is some other theory that solves these problems related to which supersymmetry was supposed to be solving, or perhaps it's just hidden or it's just around the corner. So I think this will continue to be important. Dark matter is a very important subject where also astronomy and particle physics intersect, because there are many particle physics experiments that can search for dark matter directly, for example, the LHC. And then there are dedicated experiments that look for dark matter. But of course, there is an astronomy aspect to this. So it's one of those intersections.
That's great. Well, I think we've probably come to the end. We've talked a lot about particle physics and how it links into astronomy. So thank you very much, Stefan. It's been a most enjoyable talk.
Thank you.